This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to speak with Robert Lanza, MD, who's the Vice President of Medical and Scientific Development at Advanced Cell Technology in Massachusetts. Welcome to California Politics Today.
Thank you.
I also want to say congratulations on what's apparently a big breakthrough here in creating retinal stem cells that can be used to treat a variety, or will eventually be able to be used to treat a variety of eye diseases. What exactly did you announce yesterday?
Well, what we've actually done for the first time is to actually generate what are known as retinal pigment epithelium from embryonic stem cells. Now, these are the cells that support the photoreceptors, the cones and rods that we use to see with. And this is extremely important because these cells could be used to treat literally millions of patients who potentially could go blind in the future. For instance, macular degeneration, this affects over 30 million people worldwide. And so that's one important finding here. And the second is these cells, we believe, could be one of the very first applications of embryonic stem cell technology.
Okay, where did you get your embryonic stem cells?
Well, we actually studied 11 embryonic stem cell lines. Six of these were derived with private funding at the Howard Hughes Foundation at Harvard University and the laboratory of Doug Melton.
Right.
And those we found readily turned into these cells very easily. I
read in some of the literature here that's because retinal cells are kind of like nerve cells, and stem cells gravitate to become nerve cells more easily than any other type.
Yes, that's exactly true. It turns out that these embryonic stem cells like to become neuronal. So that's one of the reasons why those embryonic stem cell lines have been so difficult to turn into other cell types.
Right.
We have been able to turn them into all virtually all the cell types of the body, but what's very important for therapy is to create them in sufficient number and in of sufficient purity to be of therapeutic value. And what we've done here is we've created a system that allows us to reliably generate large numbers of these cells with very high purity, and in fact, using gene analysis, we're able to show that they very closely resemble the body's normal retinal cells. We also were able to do various biochemical studies, marker studies, that show that they express all of the proteins that they should, and that they carry out the actual functions that we would hope they would.
Now, when you started this project, did you had a target a cell, namely the ones that are there normally now, and how did you get from the embryonic stem cell to the epithelial cell that you just said you've been able to create an almost exact replica of?
Right. Well, as you alluded to earlier, the embryonic stem cells do like to become, they have a mind of their own and like to become neuronal type cells. So this is almost a default pathway. So we found that with very little coaxing that they readily turned into these pigmented epithelial cells. And by just slightly modifying our culture conditions and plating them out on these gelatin plates so that we didn't need to expose them to animal cells, we were able to very reliably passage them using techniques that we developed over the last year or so. And they, like I said, these cells wanted to do this, and they did it very easily with very little effort. And I think by identifying the cells and passaging them using techniques that we've worked out, we can do this very reliably. And as a matter of fact, all of the stem cell lines we studied from Harvard and the two lines that we studied here at ACT did this very easily. Unfortunately, the three lines that we studied that were approved by President Bush, the so-called NIH registered lines, they proved more problematic. Once we had the conditions identified for producing these, even knowing that and with heroic efforts, they still were very reluctant to turn into these cell types. We have succeeded at doing it, but again, not only were they difficult to turn into the cell types, but we had a very hard time getting them to grow and passage in sufficient numbers to be of therapeutic value.
So the Harvard Hughes cells were better than the Bush cells.
Yes, absolutely. But again, the Howard Hughes lines, were developed using more current techniques. They also maybe earlier passage. That means that they're younger. so that it could be that not only are they younger, but also as a result they're also more robust and easier to manage.
Right. Now this term of art you're using here, passaging, mm-hmm. that's essentially the term that you use to mean transformation from a primordial stem cell into a useful particular cell.
Well, by passaging we mean growing, essentially. What you do is you grow these cells in a petri dish until they become confluent, until they've filled up the dish.
Right.
And then what you do is you have to then remove them from the dish and seed them out at a lower density, and that's
right.
called passaging. So this is very important because, yes, many different cell types have been identified, you know, to have been derived from embryonic stem cells, but the problem is you can't reliably grow them or grow them in a way that's controlled. So say, for instance, if I were to look at in a petri dish that contains embryonic stem cells, I may see some beating hot cells over on this part of the dish. I may see some hair follicles over here. I may see some cartilage cells or some muscle cells. They tend to differentiate into a hodgepodge of cell types.
Right.
So again,
yeah, as they do when they become the body, essentially, right? When
exactly. That's exactly it. They start to interact with one another, and one type of tissue interacts with another, and then they actually start doing all sorts of, like I said, very fascinating things. Like I said,
right.
you'll see a whole dish of beating hot cells, for instance.
Right. So the challenge for you and your competitors then is to develop those processes that will allow you to take what are apparently homogeneous collection of the stem cells at the beginning and make sure they all turn into epithelial retinal cells, or they all turn into nerve cells, or they all turn into muscle cells, right? So you get what you're looking for.
Yes, and that's correct. And in addition to this, of course, you know, it's very, very important to find out that those cells actually are have the properties and characteristics of the cells that you want.
Right.
So that you may have, say, a muscle cell, but, you know, is this, say, for instance, a hot cell, a smooth muscle cell,
right.
or et cetera. And in this particular case, these retinal pigment epithelial cells have very specific characteristics, and we used in this study something known as transcriptomics, again using gene analysis of all the hundreds of thousands of genes, and it turns out that the exact genes that they have that are turned on very, very closely resemble the body's natural cells. In fact, they more closely resembled the cells that we're looking for than the existing retinal cell lines that have actually been used in animals to attenuate visual loss.
So in fact they're better than the previous one.
Certainly by the assessments that we've carried out, they appear to be.
And you have a system in place now that would allow you to produce unlimited quantities of these cells?
Right. We're up to what we would call population doublings. Every time a cell divides, it's a population doubling, and we're over 30 population doublings, and that's a very, very large number, millions and millions of cells, and it's still continuing to grow.
You just said that the Harvard or Hughes cells were younger, more vigorous than the more attenuated Bush cells. Is that a danger or a worry or a problem for you that after more doublings and more doublings, they're going to lose their potency?
Well, we're talking about two different things here. One is embryonic stem cell lines are immortal. They
right.
continue to grow. What we're talking about here is having a differentiated cell that has therapeutic value, and we want to expand those into sufficient numbers. So we're no longer talking about embryonic stem cells at that point. Once we've turned the embryonic stem cell into these retinal cells, then you want to grow those cells up, and once they become a differentiated cell, they become finite. That means they start to undergo a certain number of doublings, and that's pretty normal. That's what all of our body cells do.
But not an infinite number of doublings.
Not an infinite number, but these still could be considered quite youthful relative to the natural lifespan of the cell.
So the primordial stem cells become the retinal cells, and those are then replicated many times to produce the therapeutic agents that you're going to use.
Exactly.
All right. Timing. You've got this now. How long until clinical? Are you going to move to clinical tests? And what's the timetable for all that?
Well, again, this very much depends on the resources we have available. You know, I know I may seem a bit optimistic here, but I believe with the right resources, we could be in clinical trials within 2 years. I think that these cells look extremely promising. We already have approval and have some of these animal preclinical studies underway. So assuming they go well, I would think we would be able to also be running safety studies concurrently, so that I think there's a very real chance, if things go the way we hope, that we could be ready for clinical trials within 2 years.
Have you done animal trials yet?
We have the approval. They're underway. We have the cells ready, and they're imminent.
Do you know for sure with a certain degree of certainty that you have the techniques to apply these into the retinas?
These are existing. There are already animal models in place, natural and artificial models, in rodents, rabbits, and other animal models that already are used to study these various diseases. So these are in place. These have been well developed and characterized, and so there are numerous groups that have been working with these models for years.
With these models and with human tests, are these cells injected into the blood? Are they injected into the retina? How's that done?
Yeah, there are a number of approaches. One of the main approaches would be, for instance, that you would put them on little discs and they would be placed in the back of the eye in the subretinal space. So that would be the first approach. That's the approach that is used by many groups.
Through surgery?
Yes.
And that's done now, you're saying, from with the problems, of course, being that they're not as good as yours and that there may be rejection issues.
Well, there are a number of issues here. One, of course, as you point out rightly, that it turns out rejection is profoundly important here.
Right.
So if you were to inject adult cells, we know that they will reject readily, even though the eye is an immune-privileged site.
Adult cells, you mean cells generated from adult stem cells? Or retinal epithelial cells?
Yeah, just adult retinal epithelial cells.
From somebody other than the person where they came from.
Exactly. And those do readily reject. Then there are also the fetal RPE cells.
Right.
That's what is used most often. And those reject less so. So there are actually some patients that have these that have shown profound improvement. And we still don't quite understand. Some of those do seem to be accepting the cells. Again, the eye is an immune privileged site. But in other instances, they do reject. So the hope here would be, one, that the embryonic cells would be even less immunogenic, and two is using these other technologies such as nuclear transfer or parthenogenesis, we may be able to create lines that match the patient precisely.
Okay, let me take those two. The idea being that if they're stem cell derived, they're likely to be less antagonistic, elicit less rejection, right?
Right. It seems the more primitive they are, the further back you go, the less immunogenic they are.
Okay. And then the second part, which is...
And they may, in fact, be special.
The parthenogenic solution is essentially that you take a cell from the patient and use it to activate a denucleated egg cell and create a new stem cell line that's particularly tailored to that individual, and if you generated the stem cells and then the retinal epithelial cells, you could inject them and there'd be no reaction in the rejection side because it's the same genome, it's the same.
Well,
is that the idea?
Close. There's two processes. One is the nuclear transfer, which is also often known as therapeutic cloning. That means you would take an egg, enucleate it, and then put the patient's cell in and create a line that would be specifically custom for that patient. So it would be
right.
The patient's own cells. The parthenogenesis is slightly different.
Oh,
what you would do is you would just take an egg and fool it into thinking it was fertilized, and you'd create something known as a parthenode, a microscopic ball of cells. And the unique thing there is that all the genes are maternal. They're just one set of genes. So scientifically, we call that homozygous. And what that does is it considerably reduces the complexity of the molecules that cause rejection, so that with maybe 40 or certainly less than perhaps 400 lines, we could create a bank that would match most of the United States population. By contrast, if you didn't use this so-called parthenogenesis, you would then require hundreds of thousands of lines. So that we believe that with a small number of lines created through that process, we could establish a bank of cells that could be used, like I said, to match most of the population in the United States.
So you're saying the categories of rejection processes are only about 400 different categories of those?
Well, there are a few more than that, but what it turns out, is that by reducing the complexity of the genes, it's much easier to get a match for a patient.
And you'd be equally able to get, in this particular instance, we're talking about retinal epithelial cells, from these parthenogenically generated
cells. We believe so. We did generate these cells and from primates created that way. Okay. So, I mean, you know, the studies need to be done, but there's no reason to believe that they will act any differently. Our studies using animal cells derived through the various methods suggest there isn't very much difference.
And if this were done with a patient's adult cell, adult nucleus that was put into an egg,
mm-hmm.
Then the stem cells and the specific cells that were generated from that would all be muscle cells, nerve cells, retinal cells, would all be able to run under the radar of or avoid the problem of rejection.
Absolutely. They'd be genetically identical to the patient.
So there'll be two approaches. One is to have give someone one of the 400 types of parthenogenically generated stem cell generated cells.
Right,
the
other one is already available.
Already available off the shelf at that point, versus having a customized process by which adult somatic cell transfer is used to create their own line.
Right, and that would have to be done for every patient.
Right.
You know, so, you know, if you have, you know, in the case of, say, you know, in this instance, macular degeneration, you know, you're talking millions of people. And that, you know, obviously would require a very large number of eggs.
Right.
It would require a considerable amount of effort. And, you know, again, there's a, you know, timing for other diseases. Say, you know, say, for instance, you wanted to do the same process for, say, someone who had a heart attack. You know, certainly that would, it would take many, many months to not only generate the embryonic stem cells, but also then you have to turn them in to the cell types you want. And in this case, this is a process that takes time. So that could be problematic. So, like, we did a study that we published just a few months ago where we actually used cloned stem cells that we injected into mice that had heart attacks, very severe heart attacks, 60%. And within 4 weeks, we had restored 40% of the damaged tissue. But the key there is to get those cells in right after the heart attack, immediately after the heart attack. You don't have half a year, that luxury of half a year to wait.
So that means you have to use the parthenogenic off-the-shelf technique.
In that instance. You know, certainly you could use them later, but, you know, you've missed an important window of opportunity.
Two questions about numbers. Do you have any idea, let's say everything works out great, it's 3 to 5 years from now, how much either the parthenogenic-based or the individual-based approach is going to cost?
Obviously, there would be, you know, considerable differences here. I mean,
right.
If you had a generic cell line, they, you know, grow extensively, or embryonic stem cell lines, which are immortalized and grow indefinitely. I think that, you know, you're talking about something that would be considerably less expensive because you don't need to characterize every single batch of cells.
Right.
You know, I'd be hard pressed to give you a number, but, you know, the number, of course, is going to drop very considerably the more people that this is applied to.
Okay.
I mean, you know, if you had just, you know, one or two patients, this could be quite expensive. If it's applied to very large numbers of patients, it would drop proportionally.
Now, would you be able to generate the necessary cells for large amounts of patients from a few eggs, or are you going to need a lot of eggs
through
the parthenogenic method,
or the
other method either?
Yeah, this is important. Once you have a bank of embryonic stem cells, those cells can be used for virtually all patients who need all the therapies for stem cells. In other words, you have an undifferentiated cell that's immortal that can continue to divide indefinitely, and you now have those cells in your bank. And then what you can do is, for instance, do, say, the procedure we have. We could take a few of those cells and start growing the retinal cells and have those frozen away, you know, which we have done, and they freeze and thaw very readily, and have them ready. But at the same time, say you had heart disease and we wanted to turn these into c-Kit positive cells or hematopoietic cells, we could have those ready. But the thing is that you have a stem cell that has, you know, a very, very long or unlimited lifespan, so that those can be used for everybody, for all disease types that you may be able to apply this technology to.
Okay, so it's like banking a lot of potatoes in the cellar and taking them out to make them fried, mashed, or
And being able to just keep, you know, sort of, I guess this is a terrible analogy. What was it in the Bible where, you know, Jesus broke the bread and it just kept breaking it and breaking it and it keeps feeding, you know, indefinitely? Well, that's what a stem cell is like. You can use up cells, but yet the original cells you started from will continue to divide and replenish the ones you use.
Okay.
And that's the beauty of this technology.
Okay. Now, what about the eggs? Is it going to be necessary? Will 400 parthenogenically stimulated eggs be enough to generate, say, for all the types, or
It depends on whose numbers you're looking at.
Right.
I've heard estimates, depending on how you're doing the arithmetic, down to just a few dozen lines, and then I've heard numbers as high as, 700.
Right.
I think most of the numbers that, the experts that I've spoken with, would say it's somewhere, in the range of 40 to 400. But again, you gotta be careful. That's for the majority of the population. I don't want to give you a number, if it's, 50, 60, 70%. What's going to be more problematic is that unfortunate 20, 25% of the population, they're going to be more difficult. So, you may be able to hit the majority of the population using this technology, but to hit the remaining smaller fraction will require a considerably larger number.
Okay.